All right, well, last week we started a new series, Screen Time. We want to be smart parents in the age of smart everything. And so we are talking about technology, and evidently, I'm doing pretty well. I just want to let you know, I got a text. I'm down 9% in my screen time usage. Unfortunately, I got one from a friend, and his was up, and I'm not making this. Literally, it's right here, 493,400% last week. I don't know how that happened, James. Did you live stream like the creation of the world? Like, what did you?
Because before that, I was just so awesome. I only did.
That's what I was gonna say. You had not done any, and so you bumped up to 10 minutes, and there you were. Yeah. That was amazing. I didn't know that was possible. So we are talking about technology and its place in our families. And obviously, technology is a very expansive topic that's very large. And so what I want to do is kind of limit it really to the last decade or so. And that's because while technology has always been developing and moving and changing, and there have been, I think, obviously, tremendous breakthroughs in the last 100 years or so, there was a watershed moment in 2007 that was a game changer. Everything shifted in 2007, and I would say that it dramatically changed the way that we interact with technology, but also it offered a new level of power for technology over us as well. So in us suddenly having access to technology in a way that we never had it before, what we didn't realize is that technology then had access to us and to shape us. And so in 2007, this is what happened. Whoops. Well, this was supposed to be playing. I don't do technology that well. They didn't know quite what to say about that one. It's like kind of subdued.
Three things: widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communication. An iPod, a phone,
a browser,
and an internet communicator. An iPod, a phone. Three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone.
This gives you the chills, doesn't it?
Oh.
Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
There you go. So we are going to reinvent the phone. And Steve Jobs says the iPhone is a revolutionary mobile phone and a breakthrough internet communications device, and he wasn't doing it justice. Time magazine actually understood it better than he did. The iPhone has fundamentally, or expressed it better, I should say, changed our relationship to computing and information, a change likely to have repercussions for decades to come. That year, Time magazine named iPhone the invention of the year. And just recently, it named the iPhone the most influential innovation ever. Think about that. Ever. And it wasn't wrong. The iPhone has completely changed. It took our connectivity to the internet, to the web, to everything, to a place that we never could have imagined prior to. It is completely mobile. It is with us all the time, 24/7. We can't escape it. And we don't want to. That's the other part of it. The world has changed and we've changed. Now think about this for a second. When just how far we've come in a very short amount of time. When I was a kid, I went to my grandparents' house. The phone looked like this. Everybody remember rotary phones? Today, if you try to show a teenager what a rotary phone looks like, this is what happens. Come on. They are in Arkansas, so do with that what you will. Okay, so the world has changed, and we've changed. But for our kids, you have to understand that the world hasn't changed for them, okay, for a lot of our kids. My kids were all born after 2007. So for my kids, they grew up with this. This is every day for them. My three-year-old picks this up, moves it to the camera, because you can get there without unlocking it, and then follows us around taking pictures. Which I then have to quickly edit and delete because he will follow you literally anywhere. Right? It's nothing to him. He knows exactly how to use it, and he's barely three. One of my favorite stories, Carrie and I had some friends who went to Disney World. And they had three kids, two older sons, and then a daughter who was about five, I think, at the time. And so the mom had planned the princess lunch with her daughter. And they were going to go to the castle, and they were going to have all the Disney princesses walking around and have tea with them or something. To her great chagrin, the daughter insisted that her dad go, not her mom. And so the mom is crushed. Dad is like, why am I going to this thing? So dad takes his daughter to the princess tea, and all the princesses are walking around. And of course, he's got his iPhone. And so she wants to get her picture taken with all the princesses. But then there's Pocahontas. And Pocahontas evidently was really beautiful. So the daughter says, I want my picture taken with Pocahontas, but she doesn't stop there. Dad, I want you to have your picture taken with Pocahontas. Dad's like, I don't really want to do that. You know, eventually his five-year-old daughter, I mean, how's he going to say no to that face? Persuades him. He stands up. They're standing there. He hands his phone to his daughter, and she does this. And he says, like any dad, as she's lowering the phone, he says, honey, you have to raise the phone up. We're up here. You have to raise the phone up. We're up here. Otherwise, you're taking a picture of our feet. And then she replies to him in a tone that every parent has heard from their child when mom and dad clearly just don't get it. Dad, I already took the picture. I'm texting mom. So this is the world that we live in, and we grew into it. But for our kids, right, they were born into it, okay? And so the question that we're asking throughout this series is just, what is this doing to us, right? How is technology shaping us? It is so prevalent, and we know that. Let's think about this in terms of just teenagers. 95% of teens own or have access to a smartphone. And when it says have access, it doesn't mean I'm going to go visit my friend who happens to have one. It means they can get to it at any time that they want. Okay? It just doesn't belong to them, strictly speaking. And secondly, 45% of teens say that they are online almost constantly. Now, nobody is debating these statistics right here. Everybody knows this is just reality. You do survey, this is what you find. The debate comes into what are the effects of this technology on our kids and on us. And this is because a lot of the data that is being collected and being then sorted through is not conclusive yet, is what most studies will tell you. They're not conclusive. We don't know. It's kind of a chicken and the egg thing, which came first. And so there's kind of this question of, is all of this coincidence? When we read about kids who are more depressed because they're spending time on social media, well, is it possible that the kids were depressed and that's why they're on social media, or that they kids who tend to be more depressed get on social media more, okay? So there's this question of what are these effects? And so there are those who are writing and they're saying essentially, well, look, kids are on using their phones, they're on tablets, they're having screen time, they have social media, but we can't say definitively what the effects are, okay? So is this all a coincidence? It's possible, maybe. I think that there's some reasons why we should take it pretty seriously, though. One of those is the fact that the very people who have created most of the technology that we use, especially with regard to screens, whether it's Windows or Microsoft, are the very people who are most strict about prohibiting its use in their own families. So, just for example, Tim Cook, Bill and Melinda Gates, and Steve Jobs, all high profile, on record saying they do not let the younger members of their family use, or they strictly prohibit or limit the use of screens. In fact, Melinda Gates has actually come out and said that she wished they'd done it even more. Okay. Just last month, the New York Times ran an article, and this is what it was titled, and this sounds ominous. Listen to this. A dark consensus about screens and kids begins to emerge in Silicon Valley. And in the article, the writer says this: in the last year, a fleet of high-profile Silicon Valley defectors have been sounding alarms in increasingly dire terms about what these gadgets do to the human brain. So these are the very people who are creating this technology now are sounding these dire alarms. Suddenly, rank and file, Silicon Valley workers are obsessed. No tech homes are cropping up across the region. Nannies are being asked to sign no phone contracts. A former Facebook employee in that same article says, I am convinced the devil lives in our phones and is wreaking havoc on our children. Again, in the same article, a former editor of Wired magazine and currently a CEO of another tech company, he says this: on the scale between candy and crack cocaine, it's closer to crack cocaine. He goes on. He says, we thought we could control it. And this is beyond our power to control. This is going straight to the pleasure centers of the developing brain. We're going to talk about that more next week. This is beyond our capacity as regular parents to understand. Listen to that. We thought we could control it. And this is beyond our power to control. Now, I don't know about you. When I hear that, we thought we could control it, but it's beyond our ability to control, I think Jurassic Park. Scientists who find that they can create magic, something that no one could have ever imagined, and they create it, but it has some unforeseen consequences. There's a great scene in the movie. If you've never seen Jurassic Park, it's a fantastic movie, but there's a great scene, probably the most important scene. They're having a lunch, and the man who is developed this theme park of Jurassic Park is sitting there, and he has Dr. Ian Malcolm, who's played by Jeff Goldblum, sitting there. And Dr. Ian Malcolm is blasting the hubris, the arrogance of these scientists. And he says, your scientists were so focused on what they could do, they never asked if they should. It's a great, great line. Now, to be fair, the data is inconclusive. It may be that people who go to Jurassic Park wanted to be eaten by dinosaurs. We're still waiting to see. It's a very small, sample group. Okay, so is it a coincidence? Is that what we're looking at here? Maybe. Dr. Jean Twenge is a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, and she's written several books now. Looking at and exploring the effects of social media, smartphones, screen time on adolescents. And she wrote an article that summarizes a lot of her findings for The Atlantic, and it's titled, Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation? And in it, she's looking specifically at the last 10 years, okay, from 2007 up to the present. So she wrote it just a short time ago. And then she finds this: the teenagers over the last decade have become more passive, less independent, less rebellious, less likely to use drugs or have sex, less rested, less social, and more unhappy. Now, you're looking at this list and you're thinking, well, some of these I'm not so unhappy about, right? But let's unpack this a little bit with what she has found. Kids tend to be more passive. We'll go into some of these a little bit more depth than others. Today, teenagers, you may not realize this, teenagers are statistically less likely to have paid jobs while they're in school. Again, not necessarily a bad thing, but just keep listening. So they're less likely to be working. They're less likely to have jobs. Teenagers today spend less time on homework. That might be a surprise, but that's actually from the previous generation compared to Gen X or millennials. The iGen generation of today spend less time on homework. They have about the same amount of time that they spend doing extracurricular activities, whether that's music or, you know, bands, sports, those types of things. But what that means is that when you look at the amount of hours that teenagers actually spend in their day doing what, teenagers today have more free time, more leisure time. Now, as a former youth pastor, I'll tell you, this does not surprise me at all. I can't tell you how many times I had conversations with teenagers who, on one hand, were stressed out of their minds, super anxious, and at the same time, when you said, "Why are you so busy? Why are you so stressed?" you would find that they were spending hours of their day either gaming or on their phones and doing social media. And that is Dr. Twenge's point here, is that they're more passive in the sense that they are no longer, like, they are less likely to spend time outside of their homes. They're less likely to go to a party. They're less likely to hang out with friends. They're less likely to go to work. And what are they doing? They're spending more and more and more time isolated on their phones and, as we're going to talk about, being unhappy, distressed, anxious. So they're more passive, and right along with that is that they're less independent. She says this, the allure of independence, so powerful to previous generation, holds less sway over today's teens, who are less likely to leave the house without their parents. She even talks about, anecdotally, a number of teens who talk about never going to the mall unless their parents go with them. Wrap your head around that if you grew up going to the mall, okay? The shift is stunning. 12th graders in 2015 were going out less often than 8th graders did as recently as 2009. So 12th graders staying at home, whereas in 2009, even 8th graders who couldn't drive were finding a way to get out. There was an independence that they sought. One of the ways that she measures this is that teenagers are less likely to get their driver's license at the age of 16. They're pushing that further and further back. Now, as a parent, I'm not totally unhappy with that, especially living in Dallas. I'm thinking 21 seems reasonable, maybe 30.
You have four kids. Yeah. The day your oldest turns 16.
You'll be, exactly. So, and that's exactly what she finds. And that's exactly what they find. Is that whereas, so for us, right, so for me, when I turned 16, this was a rite of passage. You went and you were going to go, "Mom, Dad, you have to be ready to take me to the DMV. I will get my driver's license. And this is what all my friends have done so that I don't have to stay home. I'm going to go to parties. I'm going to go to football games. I'm going to go hang out with friends. I'm going to get into trouble. I'm going to do all those things." Today, teenagers report that they are nagged into getting their driver's license by parents who are sick of driving them and their siblings around. Okay? So they're less independent, which means, just on a side note, that we are raising increasingly dependent children. There's a lot of ramifications with that. They're less rebellious. Now, again, we might think, well, that's great. They're not rebelling. Well, let's think about this. Is it good? In some ways, but not always. What that means is that kids are more likely to conform to their peer group. They're more likely to follow their crowd. They're less likely to do anything that would ruffle anyone's feathers. Now, why? Why? Think about this. Why do you not want to rebel at school, for example, against an authority? Well, it's one thing if you just have a proper respect for authority. But what if it's because if you do something that gets you in trouble at school, it's going to be plastered all over social media for your friends to see? See, that's a very different motivation. So social media and how rampant it is used within the teenage world, that community now, is leading to less rebellion, not because our kids are better, please, but instead because cyberbullying, because of peer pressure, because of peer group, that you cannot escape when you go home. It's always there. They are also less likely to use drugs and have sex. Again, praise God. Hold on. I'm not saying we want them to have sex and do drugs, but understand that the reason they're doing that is not because our kids have suddenly have this, you know, enlightenment and they're now suddenly good and pure children. No, it's because, again, going back to with the drug use, the more passive and independent and rebellious, this becomes part of their pattern for life. They're not going to parties where they might have opportunity to have drugs or to be offered drugs. They're not going and hanging out with friends who would have a bad influence on them. Again, that's not all bad. Again, not going to a party, you're not hooking up with your boyfriend or girlfriend. Not all bad. But let's think about the other side of this. Does that mean that they suddenly don't have raging hormones? No. It just means that they are, shall we say, satisfying those raging hormones in other ways. Now it's virtual. So now we have pornography, now we have sexting, we have these realities that we're dealing with that are, on the one hand, we have less pregnancies. Teenage pregnancy is a lot lower than it used to be. But now we have all other types of addictions and other types of ramifications that are horrific. Sexting, everybody wants to think that stuff disappears. It never disappears. Pornography, we don't have to get into it right now, but we all know at least some have some idea of the statistics of how rampant and addictive it can be. Okay, so there's all kinds of ways this is not necessarily good news. They're less rested. I won't get into all the statistics on this, but suffice to say, over the last 10 years, and especially the last 6 or 7 years, teenagers are getting less than 7 hours of sleep, which by sleep experts, you need to be getting over 7. Really, teenagers should be getting 9 hours of sleep. That's healthy. Anything below that is unhealthy. Below 7, you are sleep deprived. Okay, it's not good for developing brains. Kids are staying up in their rooms. They're on their phones. I've seen this firsthand. This was before smartphones had really become all the everything that is today. I remember going to see family, and I was sharing a room with my cousin. And he's about 14 years younger than me, so he's quite a bit younger. At the time, he was probably 14 or 15. And he was literally up all night, which kept me up all night. He would close his phone, because I think it was one of them actually closed. It would vibrate. He'd open it. He'd text for a while with the light on. He'd close it. 20 minutes later, open it again. Literally all night long. How can that be good for your brain? Okay. So they're less rested. They're less social. Again, they're not going out with their friends. From 2000 to 2014, the number of kids who spent time with their friends is down 40%. I mean, it's staggering, these numbers, okay? And then they're more unhappy. You might think, our kids aren't going out with their friends, but they're finding other ways to interact socially. So there's got to be something good to that, or maybe they're finding joy on their phones and on social media, hanging out with their buddies or gaming. It couldn't be further from the truth. Every study that Dr. Twenge is reporting on here all say the same thing, and this is her conclusion. The results could not be clearer. Teens who spend more time than average on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy. And those who spend more time than average on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. Really simple application here. Not get into a lot of application today, but I'll give you one. Improve your kids' mood. Let them do anything but be on a screen. I mean, just pick something. Literally anything is better than being on a screen. There's not a single exception. All screen activities are linked to less happiness, and all non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. She goes on, the more time teens spend looking at screens, the more likely they are to report symptoms of depression. Teens who spend 3 hours a day or more on electronic devices are 35% more likely to have a risk factor for suicide, such as making a suicide plan. Okay. So, again, this is all coincidence. It was something going on with these particular teenagers that led them to spend more time on their phones and more time on social media. Maybe. Dr. Twenge's point in the article, if you read it, is that since 2007, the statistics have taken such a drastic shift that there's no other explanation. That's her argument. She looks at 2007 as this watershed moment that from that point on, if you look statistically, and I'll do it for you, at mental health of teenagers, the phone usage goes like this, and the mental health goes like this in every measurable category. Yeah, Alan.
Are we only talking about smartphones, or are we talking about computers, any kind of electronic?
It's really screens. She's highlighting smartphones because, again, it's it so drastically changed our connectivity on a mobile level of just having our phones with us all the time. So she's not saying that if the smartphone had never come along and you had a computer in your house and they were like trading off and using it, I think she's going to say, or I'll just say, you're not going to see the same effect. What comes is, I never have to put this down. I'm connected all the time. It never leaves. And understand that social media, while that exists on your computer, that's almost never where teens interface with it. It's always on their phone. And so that's why it's so significant. So in one sense, yeah, we're talking about technology. In another sense, we're talking about screens. But in another sense, we're talking about mobile screens, tablets and iPhones. So we sort of like narrow it down from there. Okay. What she's arguing here is that it could be coincidence, but it seems highly unlikely. For her, there is no other. Her argument is that there's no other societal event, if you will, that better explains or sufficiently explains and accounts for this change statistically of mental health for teenagers, apart from the invention of the iPhone and then all of its subsequent variations. I think there's another one, though. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I think the other thing we recognize is that there was another event that happened around 2007, and that was the Great Recession. And so at the same time that the iPhone comes along, understand that two things happen. One is parents are increasingly, and adults, right, are under a lot of pressure that we'd never experienced before. If you remember that time, there's a lot of stress. Suddenly I have this that allows me to self-medicate in a way that I've never been able to self-medicate before. I remember when I bought my first iPhone, Andy Weilman ordered me to do it because he needed to be able to reach me more easily than my flip phone. And I went and got it, and I remember thinking, I will never be bored again. I mean, I literally had that thought, okay? So at the same time that you have all this pressure within society, adults and parents are suddenly finding that this is a bit of a release. I can check out here. So kids who suddenly have their own, and now their parents have their own, and are also getting using it more and more. And then the other thing with the Great Recession is that families increased, how do I put this? More and more families had to move to two-parent income to offset unemployment or job loss. And so again, you put all of those things together, and you create this moment that begins to shape and to reshape the landscape of teenage mental health. Okay, so again, coincidence? I think not. What do we do? What do we do? I've told you everything that you probably feared and knew, maybe to a certain extent. What do we do? What do we do? I think we have options. Some of you would look good in blue and white, and you know what I mean? It's.
Maurice, I can see you in one of those times.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Let me give you a couple of sort of almost like case studies to help us think through this, I think, in a better way, okay, rather than just abject fear, okay? So a few years ago, a Swiss scientist named Conrad Gesner, he wrote a book. And he warns, this is nothing new, he warns that modern people in the modern world, excuse me, would be overwhelmed with data, okay? And this would be confusing and harmful to people's minds, okay? Now, here's the thing. He's absolutely right. Anybody disagree with this? Yeah, he's absolutely right. Here's the thing. He wasn't writing in the 21st century. He wasn't writing in the 20th century or the 19th century. No, he was writing in the 16th century. And what was he concerned about? This bad boy, the printing press. And he was not the only one. Throughout Europe, so when it first was invented, understand, it had all the novelty of new technology today. Everybody's excited. Printing press, this is incredible. Look what we can do, okay? Granted, it took a lot longer for this information to be distilled throughout Europe than today. But decades later, philosophers, scientists, social scientists, politicians, statesmen begin to think and wonder and question, okay, how is this really affecting society? What is it doing to us? And they were not overly thrilled. there were politicians and statesmen who wrote and warned that if people get their information, their news from these things, it would lead to isolation. It would lead to depression and fear because you're processing information on your own instead of as a community. They feared what would happen if kids had books, that they would go and isolate themselves in their rooms to read instead of being part of the community and being outside. What a horrible idea. It's terrible. Can you imagine if your kids went to their rooms to read? It's terrifying.
Cats and dogs living together.
Gottfried, yeah, exactly. Mass chaos. Gottfried Wilhelm, philosopher and mathematician in 1680, said the horrible mass of books that keeps growing might lead to a fallback into barbarism. Why? Because if you have so many ideas exposed, who's there to help you filter through what's right and what's wrong? You're going to have all these different ideas, and everybody's going to have access to all these ideas, and it's going to lead to chaos, right? Leo Tolstoy in War and Peace, he says, the most powerful of ignorance's weapons is the dissemination of printed matter. Okay, so is the printing press good for society? Okay, so I'm going to say yes. I like to read. Okay, but here's the deal. Here's the deal. Yeah, John.
Well, I'll just throw this out there. Yes and no, because whose viewpoint are you reading from? Because if you're watching CNN or MSNBC, how many people believe what you're actually seeing? I mean, are you being fed information that they want you to read about? Or I mean, how many times has the news been wrong about this, about the story? They've gotten missed facts, but you don't hear about those corrections. You only hear what the flash news is, right? Same thing goes with printing. You know, if they want you to, you know, is the information you're getting real? Or is it?
Yeah. So in our world, so let's stick to the printing press for right now, because you're right. We're getting into the information age, which is so much more than what they were dealing with the printing press. So, but I think we can use it. Okay, I think we can use the printing press to say this: is it good? Well, yeah. I think there's been a lot of good things that came out of the printing press. All kinds of good uses for it, like the Bible. Okay, so. The mass production of scripture to put into people's hands never would have happened apart from the printing press. At the same time, what's that?
The Reformation
leaned heavily on the ability to disseminate printed materials all over Europe. Okay. At the same time, the same printing press a few generations later is used to print propaganda for Nazi Germany. So is the printing press intrinsically good? No, it's a tool. Useful. Okay? Let me give you one more. Anybody know who this is? This is Robert Propst. Robert Propst is famous for one thing. He invented something. He invented the cubicle. Don't hate him. Don't hate him. Now, in fairness, he did not set out to create the mindless, mindless monotony and conformity that the cubicle represents today. It's not what it wasn't his intention. He intended to create a new and better workspace for people. He wanted to give them more desk space that they could utilize more easily. He wanted to create collaboration within the office by having open space. And he wanted you to be able to personalize it because it's got those walls that you could put pin push pins in and put pictures and stuff up. Okay, so that was his intention. He spent his entire life lamenting how the cubicle was used. And at the end of his life, he said this: the cubicalizing of people in modern corporations is monolithic insanity. So companies took his idea that basically was a box, and they turned it into the soulless work environment that it is today. So again, the cubicle, classic case of something that was intended for good being used for, we'll just call it what it is, evil. Okay? Evil. Right. Any tool, this is my point, any tool, whether it is a printing press, hugely influential, or as innocuous as a box, like a cubicle, any tool can be used for good or evil. The question is, how is it used? How is it being used? And how do we use it? And here's the other part. The more powerful the tool, the greater its propensity either for doing good or evil. And make no mistake, technology in many ways is the most powerful tool that we have ever wielded. But I don't think the answer is to move to Lancaster County. I know you're relieved. Some of you are considering it. I know a nice place if you decide to. But I don't think that's the answer. But here's the thing. I also don't think that the answer is, listen, follow me here. I don't think the answer here is to create enough rules or good enough rules or make our kids into rule followers in order to protect them and ourselves from technology. I don't think that that is sufficient. I think that rules are part of the answer, but it's not the whole answer. And before we get to the rules, I think we have other better questions to ask. Here's the problem. You can't legislate morality. If there's one thing that government has taught us over a large number of years and an amount of legislation that has been created is that you cannot legislate people into being good. There are always ethical questions that are going to arise that we never could have anticipated. You can't anticipate every single one. Think about the questions that we have today in terms of our society that we could never have imagined 10, 20 years ago, even beyond technology. We live in an increasingly and extraordinarily complex world. And so whatever rules we think we might be able to create, whether for our kids or for ourselves, they are going to be antiquated, they are going to be insufficient before we have even turned the page. Okay. And so what we need to do is, while we want to talk about some practical applications, and I promise we will do that in the coming weeks, you have my word, we want to think more about the kind of people that we want our kids to be. We want to raise kids who are wise, who will use technology however it changes, however it develops, whatever new thing comes around the bend, wisely. Rules can help us do that, but they're only a means to an end. So what we want to ask is, what kind of people do we want our kids to become? Not how do we protect them? That's part of it, but it's not all of it. And maybe a better question is this, and this is where we're going to go next week. What kind of people does God want us and them to be? One of the dirty little secrets about technology, moms, dads, grandparents, is that in many ways we are just as susceptible and maybe more susceptible than our kids. We grew into it, remember? You remember the frog that boils? It's a danger, to fall into the do as I say, not as I do category when it comes to our technology. There's no one monitoring me. I mean, my phone's starting to now. It tells me my screen time, but otherwise, and I can just ignore that. There's no one monitoring me, coaching me along the way. My kids, theoretically, I'm doing that for them. And so I need to ask myself the hard question, okay, how am I using technology? Physician, heal thyself. Okay. So I think many, in some ways, the most important question that we want to be asking as we ask this question, how is technology changing us? We have to start with, who are we supposed to be? Who are we supposed to be as followers of Jesus Christ? And then we ask the question, and this is, if you write anything down, this is it, is how I use technology making me a better follower of Jesus? Is how I'm using technology making me a better parent? Is the way that I'm using technology making me a better spouse? Am I a better friend because of how I use technology? Am I a better neighbor because of how I use technology? And if not, what needs to change? So that's where we're going. This week, I just wanted to frame the question. I just wanted to create the whole landscape of this thing. And next week, we're going to ask this question, who does God want us to be? Who has He made us to be? And we're going to talk about, I'll save it for next week. Okay?